Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 12th of April. This hour, one of the first major surveys of 2016 that measures what parents are thinking about the state of schools. Two organizations have put this together, Pathways in Education, a nonprofit national network of public education programs helping students earn their high school diploma and prepare for post-secondary success, and YouGov, which is a pioneer and global online research and innovative polling. They have just recently released the results of this election year survey gauging parents' attitudes. The study surveyed nearly 1,700 respondents, and they are particularly interested in what issues underserved families, particularly low-income, African-American, and Latino, are prioritizing in their struggle to achieve a quality education. More than 1,100 of the poll's respondents make under $50,000 a year. They have some very interesting responses, and we'll hear all about them during the course of this hour. We have two guests with us. Gerard Robinson is one of our guests. Gerard is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He works on education policy issues, including choice in public and private schools, implementation of K-12 standards, innovation in for-profit educational institutions. He was Commissioner of Education for the state of Florida and Secretary of Education for the Commonwealth of Virginia and President of the Black Alliance for Educational Options. He is now Chairman of the Board there. Gerard, thank you very much for joining us this hour. Looking forward to the conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Also joining us is Peter Groff. He is a former state Senate president of Colorado. He's a noted education reformer as well as a policy and political analyst. He has served as a visiting fellow at the Johns Hopkins University School of Education and also as 47th president of the Colorado State Senate, the first African American in Colorado to ascend to that post. And we are delighted to have you with us. Thanks very much for being with us, Peter Groff.
Kathleen, thanks for having me on.
Our pleasure. Let's start with this because you intuitively think that this is true, but I think that we're having real problems attracting people to teaching right now. That it would appear that most of the respondents to this survey said that the best thing that can happen in a school for their child is to have a really qualified and good teacher. Do they have qualified and good teachers? Gerard, you want to start?
Sure. So there are two things. First, I want to thank all the hardworking teachers who are in our classrooms providing, you know, an education to students every day. So that's part one. We definitely have pockets of excellence in different states and cities, but we also have challenges where we have teachers who either, A, are working out a subject, or, B, are doing the best they can, but we don't see the correlation between the results on academic achievement tests. So there's some great things moving along the way, but the research is real clear. If you have a qualified teacher, you'll see a year-plus gain in reading and math, and the opposite with a teacher less qualified. So having those teachers in front of our students is a smart thing to do.
Peter, how do you define qualified teacher and a good teacher?
Well, you know, The unique thing about education and where we are is now states will have the opportunity to do just that, figure out what it means to be qualified. Before, when we had No Child Left Behind, as you and your listeners know, the president signed one of the few bipartisan pieces of legislation to come through in the last couple of years in December of last year, which kind of took away the federal definition of what it meant to be qualified, you know, before you had to have a degree and a variety of other things. But I think now states will have some flexibility, and I'm sure they're drawing on people like Gerard, who was able to run two states to help on this. But they'll be up to the states to determine what does it mean to be qualified. Is it experience in that subject? Is it a degree in that subject? Is it a combination of both? So it'll be up to states to make that determination. I think what teachers are looking for, what parents are looking for when they walk into a classroom is somebody who has a command of that subject. And when their child comes home, they're able to tell within that child's work what that teacher has taught them and the command that that teacher has been able to use to teach that kid.
Do both of you worry? We're starting to see initial reports here in the state of Wisconsin and elsewhere that a lot of young people are simply not going into teaching these days.
Kathleen, I'll take that. It's Peter. I think that is a huge problem. When you look at countries around the world that do really well with preparing their kids for higher education and a career, they draw from the very best young people that they have to go into the classroom. We have not been able to do that in recent years. And Secretary Duncan, on his way out, talked about the importance of getting young people who are best and brightest to consider teaching and to set up several different programs to try and get those young people into the classroom or at least consider teaching for a while early on in their careers.
Mm-hmm. Gerard, what do we do about that? How do we get these wonderful young people to enter this most honorable profession?
Well, one thing is we have to get existing or former professionals to encourage their students to actually become teachers, and here's why. I had an opportunity in Virginia to speak to a number of education leaders, and I do an exercise where I will have everyone stand if you're a maternal or paternal grandparent was a teacher, if your mom or dad was a teacher, of course, you're a teacher. Often when we say how many of your children are in education, fewer than 20% of the leaders stand. Some of the teachers have frankly said, you know what, the profession isn't what it used to be, so I coach my son or daughter out of teaching. So that's one aspect. We've got to do that. Number two, we also have to be very critical of the media, who will either have television shows or movies where they portray teachers and the teaching profession in a very negative light. When we discuss business persons or politicians, sure, some of them are put in a negative light. But we don't see a number of movies or television shows across the board who are putting the teacher profession in a great light. So I think there's a media component. And lastly, let's also be honest and talk about money. When a college student is going to graduate from a college in May or June of this summer, many of them are bypassing teaching, not because their heart isn't in it, it's because the economics aren't there. And so we're going to find a way of addressing teacher, but also addressing pay for performance along the way.
Mm. It's so interesting. I'm sure you've had these experiences as well. I recently went to a fairly significant high school reunion, and to a person, we all mentioned teachers who had this enormous influence on our lives. And I look back at who our high school teachers were, and they were so qualified and, for the most part, really good teachers, really significant people in our lives. We underestimate, I think, how important that profession is.
Absolutely. And I just sent an email to a high school teacher of mine 2 days ago to ask her for her advice on how to raise money for a foundation that I'm running. It wasn't the folks who I've known since I graduated from East High School in Denver in the very early 80s. It was the teacher who kind of got my mind around public service and the role that we can play in terms of changing folks' lives. And I emailed her to ask her for her advice. So I think you're right that a lot of times, and Gerard is so right, that the media really hasn't held up our teachers. We'll hold up our sports stars. We'll hold up our movie stars. We'll hold up a variety of other folks who have an impact, whether negative or positive, on our young people. But we won't talk about the teachers who day-to-day prepare our kids for college and career.
Here's a disturbing part of your survey. When asked about educational equality, nearly three-quarters of parents, 74%, believe students of color are not afforded the same education opportunities as their peers. What are their concerns? And that is a very large number. Gerard?
Well, one concern is academic. If you look at a number of high schools in the country, whether it's city, suburban, or rural, that are serving students of color, a number of them lack appropriate advanced placement courses. And we know that's important to, you know, creating a pipeline to college. Some of it is on a curriculum standpoint. Number two, we've got to make sure that we raise expectations for students to say that you can go to college, that's important, but we've got to make sure that we have the human resources in place to encourage that. What I can tell you from classroom conversations to conversations in state capitals that there are a lot of parents who simply believe the deck is stacked against their children. And this is, what, 62 years after Brown v. Board of Education and, you know, a number of years from the Rodriguez case. So I think we have to do a better job of taking our message from the state capitol and school boards and making sure that it reaches real parents whose kids go to school every day. And this survey is, I think, speaks to that.
Mm-hmm. Peter, what do you say?
I think Gerard's right. I do think that parents are concerned when they have kids with special needs, that their kids aren't receiving the proper care in the classroom that they need, whether it's either assisting them both in and outside the classroom, whether it's English language learners. As those numbers grow, parents are also seeing that they're not receiving the same opportunities as English learners who have been here for a while. Even when you talk about folks who have been here for 5 or 10 years, receive a kind of a different set of educational opportunities. And parents know this instinctively. We talk a lot about what low-income parents aren't doing, but we don't talk a lot about what low-income parents know. And they know that if you live on one side of town, that zip code determines the opportunities that you are not receiving compared to a zip code across town that's a richer part of the community.
Mm-hmm. What do we do about that, Gerard?
Well, we have to encourage parents to become more involved in their child's education, whether that's participating in PTA meetings, but it also requires parents to attend school board meetings. A lot of those school board meetings take place once a month. A number of them are now either live streamed for those who can't make it in person, or they're put on public television. So there's got to be more civic engagement in the process as well.
Mm-hmm. Peter, what do you think?
I think, one, we need to look at how states are divvying the dollars. When I was Senate president, we talked a lot about the fact that charter schools receive less money than other public schools. We talked about how rich neighborhoods and communities throughout Colorado are able to raise money outside of the school to boost what the state sends. So we've got to figure out a better way to ensure that all public schools receive the same amount of money and opportunities and resources across the board, so that some students don't come out better prepared, again, for college and career than others, just based on the resources that the state offers.
A lot of the parents, I found interestingly, cited this transition from 8th grade to 9th grade as being one that's difficult for a lot of young people, and they were asking for a special kind of help, advisors and maybe a mentor to help students make the transition. Why is that a hard one for a lot of students?
Well, 8th grade is a... No, go ahead, Peter.
Well, I was going to say, from a personal standpoint, I have a freshman in high school now. So he has two parents, multiple advanced degrees in the house, and it has been a struggle for him, but we've had resources to better prepare him. A lot of parents just don't have those resources, and so when a young person brings home a C in our house, that's not acceptable. But we're able to say, hey, here is a tutor, let's go and work with him, and we'll pay that tutor whatever we need to pay him outside of the school to help get you to where you need to be, which is where he is now. A teammate of his doesn't have those same opportunities, and so that teammate has struggled to get the type of grades that he needs to even be eligible to remain on the team. So a lot of it is resources, and adolescents also go through a variety of other changes, and making that leap from middle school to high school and what needs to happen and what teachers expect. And not all students are coming in equally. And so a lot of times, again, when we talk about equity, those students who have resources are able to overcome just the regular changes that go through a young person between middle school and high school. let alone some of the other outside pressures that they might face.
So, Gerard, what do we need? A mentor? Maybe somebody who's an upperclassman or woman who is assigned to an incoming student? Or what works?
So we realize that 70% of the students who drop out of high school do so in the 10th grade, which shows why making sure students leave middle school to grade 9 is important. We need a few things. One, surely we need more counselors and adults, some of those not inside the classroom, who can serve as a mentor. But this is where I'd say we need a civil society approach. Now, if you take a look at the results, only 6% of the parents said that it's not significant for their students to, it's just not a big thing for transition. 6% believe it's not significant. The vast majority believe so. While I think we need to involve public school leaders and personnel, we also need to bring in other adults and organizations, whether it's bringing in people from the business community who can serve as a mentor in an after-school program or summer program, whether it's faith-based leaders, who can provide that kind of service, you know, during the weekend. But we cannot rely solely on our public school system to do this for a host of reasons. They cannot, nor should they take it all on. But if we know that many kids are going to drop out in the 10th grade, 9th grade is important, but guess what? They did not become illiterate or have trouble with math all of a sudden in the 9th grade. That starts earlier, which is why we have to even address this toward early childhood learning as well.
We have much more of the survey to go through, and we welcome your phone calls as well. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We always love to read your comments there, and we're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. We're looking at a survey done during an election year. You know, the education's been discussed a little bit in the presidential race, but not extensively. I guess we'd probably like to see a lot more of it. This is a survey on parents' views on education, a comprehensive portrait of what issues underserved families, particularly low-income African-American and Latino families, are seeing as important in their struggle to achieve a quality education. Would you agree? It's a teacher in the classroom. I think that's right up there, and that will help somebody enormously in life and in achieving a quality education to have very qualified teachers. And how do you define that? They looked at a number of other issues. A surprisingly high number thought that there was a much higher dropout rate from high school than there actually is. We'll look at special education. We'll look at support for dropout reengagement programs, school selection, how parents select schools for their children. They also asked about neighborhoods and whether or not they're safe, preparation for college, how clean and secure the facilities are, preparation for college. So those are other areas we will talk about with our guests. And our guests are Peter Groff, former president of the Colorado State Senate and a former President Obama administration appointee, national education expert, Gerard Robinson, senior fellow at American Enterprise Institute. He has worked as a Florida education official and expert on K through 12, specializing also in historically black colleges and universities. And we'll be with you in just a moment. Lines are a humming, and we're getting messages as well. So we'll be with you. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls for our guests. And we start with Matt in Middleton. Hi, Matt.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
I wanted to make a few comments and then maybe pose a question. My kids are in private school, and the transition from grade school to high school, at least for them, doesn't occur at eighth grade. They leave private Catholic school, what we would call elementary school, after fifth grade and enter a preparatory academy at sixth grade, which goes all the way through high school. So there is no transition for them from eighth to ninth grade. It's simply ninth grade. And you already see your older peers there with you, so there's no social stigma that goes along with that or separation between middle school and high school. And then as far as needing tutoring, we've had a child that's needed some remedial work, and all of the teachers at the school offer additional study during study hall periods if the teacher's free, or both before and after school. So if a student is struggling, they can go and see the teacher. And the teacher also makes the effort of notifying the parents that, hey, you know, the last couple of tests, they haven't done well. You know, they're not telling me what the problem is. Do you mind if I pull them out of study hall or keep them after school? And that, to me, has really helped when my students have struggled. And they also have older peers, because they're the 6th, 7th, and 8th are together with high school. If they're struggling with a math concept or a science concept, they can pull students out of high school when during a study hall to get tutoring actually at school.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering if those types of concepts that are being used in the private school system would work in a public school system.
Yeah, interesting. Middle school is kind of a strange configuration, isn't it, Gerard?
Some would say it is. There are scholars at Harvard like Paul Peterson who has questioned the whole idea of whether we need middle schools, and whether we should use, if a public school model, a Catholic school model, grades 1 to 8. There are places where the configuration makes sense. There's also historical reasons why we have middle schools, particularly given a rise in population in certain parts of the United States. Also with social science at the time, which said it made sense to separate middle from high school. So I think there are lessons that we can learn from private schools, to take that to say that there's nothing that private schools can't learn from public schools. But there's some things that can fall over. I attended private school, in fact, Catholic schools from grades 1 to 12. I went to grade 1, grade 8. First time I left my school was to go to high school, so it was a little different. But remember, within the public school system, we actually have small high schools. We also have models that remove what we would call a middle school, just to experiment. So there are things within the public school system we can learn from ourselves.
Mm-hmm. And you certainly need resources, don't you, Peter, to have the kind of wonderful services that Matt's children are getting?
Yeah, I think Matt did bring up a couple of really interesting points. But Kathleen, you're right that Matt pays for that. So he pays to ensure that there's a counselor available, or that there's tutoring available. In public school, it's a little bit different of a situation. But I do think that the fact that 6 through 12, I believe Matt said, all of those young people are in there together. And so they get to know upperclassmen. They get to know folks who have taken the class before them, and creating relationships so that maybe they can go to a fellow student and say, hey, you had this class or even this teacher before. How can I work this better? And so I think maybe having that transition, maybe even later in high school, whether it's from 8 to 10 or having more folks together, would make some sense. However, being public schools, it's difficult to have the facilities to hold that many people. The one last thing that I will say that public schools, I think, are trying to do is get information to parents faster. I know in Prince William County, Virginia, where I live, there's a thing called a parent portal, and we can see how our kids are doing on a test that was given that day if the teacher puts it in. We have had some very dedicated teachers who have made sure that the information is there so that we can keep abreast of what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there are things that the public schools can learn from private schools in terms of making sure that those kids have assistance and that parents have information moving forward.
Thanks, Matt, for your call. Let's go to Ann in Viroqua. Hi, Ann.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm a parent. I grew up with great public schools in Wisconsin. Nobody in my rural area went to a private school. They were just unheard of. I got into the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I was in the top 1% of the ACT scores. It was no problem. We had excellent teachers. But the last 30 years, the rollbacks in education and the vilification of teachers and the race to the top. I mean, how can we expect children to learn? My daughter cannot afford to go to college. I went to college at the University of Wisconsin. It was $500 a semester. Working class people could go to a world-class university in this state, and they no longer can. It's outrageous. And the morale at schools is terrible. And if you want to look for a model, don't go to the American Enterprise Institute and all of this privatization just for profit. Look at Finland. They have the best education system. They have the best teachers. Bernie Sanders is right. This has got to end.
Thanks, Ann, for the call. And a similar kind of comment from Matt on an email. How in the world do you encourage high school graduates to enter teacher training programs when the state, and he's talking about Wisconsin, passes legislation that punishes teachers by denying them collective bargaining, forcing them to pick up large portions of their retirement and health care premiums, even though their contracts were legally bargained for, and regularly blaming teachers for student failure or low achievement, although there are a host of issues working against student achievement. Gerard.
So two parts. One, American Enterprise Institute is definitely the right place to come because we focus on freedom, opportunity, and enterprise. And if you look at our public school system today, a lot of the teachers, in fact, have their retirement plans invested in the market, and a number of those who are actually seeing gains are from investments that are made in the private sector. So there's a role for the private sector. Part two, there is a need for us to evaluate teachers to see a correlation between their training and how it's going to impact student results. Yes, there are a number of factors outside of schools, particularly families, that play a role, but those things are important. As it relates to No Child Left Behind and federal policy, there is a federal role, I think a small footprint. And if nothing else, when we look at Finland and we say it's the best system, well, let's remember that in order to teach there, you have to finish in the top 10% of your class. That's not what we find in most states, although we have some who finish in the top 5% who teach. So if we want to use international models, we've got to do an apples-to-apples comparison. While there are some challenges across the board, I still think we have one of the healthier systems of education. We just have to have all pistons working at a better rate.
When you looked at the survey done by all the parents that you surveyed, did they find that they had a lot of choices and wanted a lot of choices when it came to public education, charter schools, parochial schools, private schools? What were they looking for?
What we did see in the survey was that there weren't a lot of options and choice with regard to bringing students back into the system once they dropped out. The group that funded this is called Pathways in Education, and they engage in dropout recovery programs all across the country. And what we have seen as we've tried to grow this program across the country is that there are very few opportunities for young people to re-engage in the education system. But this poll, and Gerard can also talk about polls that he's seen and done, is that parents are looking for options, options within the public school system. So whether that's charter schools or magnet schools, online education, homeschooling in some situations, parents want to be able to ensure that the young people that they have are met where they are. Not every young person learns the same way, and we've now seen that over years and years of study, and Ann kind of talked about when she grew up how good public education was, and the same for me in Denver. But I think as we've grown and done more studying, we've seen that every single child, even children that grow up in the same house, learn differently. And parents should have the option to ensure that the way that their child learns, that there is a public option for them to succeed.
And how do you respond to, we're getting a lot of messages, and it may be because we're in Wisconsin, and we went, as you know, through Act 10 a few years ago, this idea that there are a lot of people, and we're starting to see studies here, and we talked about it earlier, people not going into teacher training programs In this state, teachers don't have collective bargaining. They have lost some of their income because of retirement benefits gone and health care premiums going up. And there has been kind of this anti-teacher rhetoric that we've heard from some politicians in the state of Wisconsin. How does that factor into all that we're talking about this hour? Gerard?
Well, if you take a look at polls, for example, I'm taking a look at our one result. It says, please indicate the importance of each of the following when choosing a school for your child. When we use the term school choice, immediately we think either charter or, because you're in Wisconsin, the Milwaukee Parental Choice Program, which is now statewide. We've got to remember two things. Parents are very clear as to why they choose school. You know, number one, you know, get quality teachers, safe neighborhood, preparation for college, even the integrated use of technology. So if some parents decide to participate in a charter school or a voucher program in Milwaukee or Racine, a lot of times it's driven by factors of safety, cleanliness, preparation for college, and it's not an anti-teacher piece. Surely with all the politics that took place with Governor Scott Walker and those in the state, I could see why there are some people who believe it's anti-teacher, but also let's remember there's a pro-teacher aspect. We practice choice all the time. Middle-class families can move to neighborhoods and have great schools. But when 80%, 83% or so of your students in the United States attend schools assigned by zone or neighborhood, and you're assigned to a school that fails, is it anti-teacher to give a parent an opportunity to choose a better school, or is it anti-parent to tell a child and a parent, this is the school you have, and while we wait to fix it, this is the best we can do? I think that's simply not the right way to go.
Why don't we just equalize the amount of money that every district gets, no matter how poor it is, no matter how rich it is? Peter?
Some states have done that, but the problem is when there's additional money needed, that rich community can do a fundraiser. That rich community can decide, well, we're going to pull together money for parents and do this kind of outside the school. I've seen that in my own county. But when I visited places like Red Hook in Brooklyn or the south side of Chicago where parents don't have that option, then they're stuck with the amount of money that the state gives. So even though there might be equality in terms of how much the state gives, and very few states do it that way, there's still going to be that need for additional dollars, whether it's for sports uniforms, whether it's for field trips, whether it's for the variety of other things that teachers would like to use to enhance what kids are learning, but the school can't pay for it. Rich counties are able to take care of that outside of the school and outside of what the state gives. Poor parents and poor communities are not.
Right. James in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hey, I have to go back to the first couple of points that were made really in the conversation. And the first one, just to provide maybe a little bit of a different perspective regarding qualifications or credentials when determining whether or not a teacher is qualified, and differentiating that from what it means for quality teaching. In other words, significant amount of research out there suggests that there is not so much a correlation necessarily between advanced degrees and student outcomes, but rather the quality of teaching, which then becomes really a question around for the district to consider how do we go about continuing to develop quality teaching practices within the district, which really also speaks to not only individuals sort of growing as a professional or growing in their practice, but then also strengthening that community of adult learning within a school to really tackle problems of practice. The second thing that I'd like to go back to is the idea of pay for performance, which holds some significant concerns. One of your guests today mentioned pay for performance. And as far as retaining teachers and attracting teachers to the profession, the pay for performance model is in some ways, I think, maybe a little bit almost disrespectful from the standpoint that essentially what we're saying is if we give you a little more money, well, maybe you'll work a little bit harder. And I think that holds, concern, because teachers go to school every day and they're in classrooms and are working to do their very best, regardless of what, you know, their pay may be. So it's really more around, you know, growing those teacher practices. And as far as retention goes, then rather than pay for performance, I think, you know, young teachers come into teaching not really seeing a clear career path. In other words, how do we go about providing opportunities for teachers to step into teacher leadership roles, for example, mm-hmm. Where they could then further their career within teaching? Because most of the time, you know, a quality teacher, if they want to actually advance their career, they go into administration.
All right, James, thanks for your call. Gerard.
So 2 points. A number of deans of education would agree that pedagogy makes a lot of sense. And so they're either bringing in former teachers who were really good at pedagogy and getting results and are actually mentoring teachers in the way that we've mentored principals for years. So deans of education are stepping in to fill the gap. Number two, there's also research to show that the longer a teacher stays in the profession, he or she will get better. And so there are actually career paths set up to say, you know, 1 to 2 years in the classroom with a mentor. Number two, if we see great results, let's continue to keep you in the classroom because the caller is correct. A lot of teachers who would rather be in the classroom leave because there's more money and professional development and opportunities in administration. And lastly, what I would say about pay for performance, teachers are the ones who came to me and said, listen, I'm working with Jerry or John. We get paid the same amount of money. I'm actually getting better results, putting in more work. Shouldn't I actually receive more compensation for the results I'm getting? So that's something that teachers, in fact, see as unfair, not something that researchers think is a problem alone.
Peter, you want to weigh in?
I do. I wrote a paper recently, which folks can go and read if they're really, really bored and need something to put them to sleep. The Common Sense Policy Roundtable. .com a couple of years ago or a year ago on the Douglas County, Colorado pay for performance. And I was struck when I looked at the program that they've created was that it was, as Gerard just said, the teachers were coming to them saying, we're really doing great things in our classroom. When we're allowed to be innovative and when the school and the county and the state kind of moves out of our way and allows us to do innovative things in the classroom, we are really driving students. And I think that we get in this conversation that does a disservice to teachers because we need to start treating them like the professionals that they are. Professionals in every other sector in this country are paid for the great work that they do, but we don't do that for our teachers. And I think it's time to begin to look at our teachers as the professionals that they are and really pay them for the great work that they do. Katie Haycock, who's the CEO of EdTrust, says, and I quoted it in the paper, that when you have a young person, no matter the background, when they have 2, 3, or 4 strong teachers in a row, they will eventually excel. But if they have one teacher who's bad, they may not recover from that. And we have too many teachers who are just not being paid at the highest levels for the great work that we're doing. And we need to reward them for the performance that they're putting day in and day out in the classroom.
James, thanks very much for the call. This hour, we're talking about a survey done by Pathways in Education, a national network of free public education programs that help students earn their high school diploma and prepare for post-secondary success. Most of those students are at-risk young people, or they struggle financially or socially, have challenges that prevent them from being successful in traditional school environments. The survey was done recently, and it looks at parents' views on education, what it is that parents are concerned about, what they feel makes for a quality education, what they're looking for, if they're able to find it. And we have two guests this hour talking about the results of that survey. Peter Groff is former state Senate president in Colorado. He has been a visiting fellow. He's now visiting fellow at the Johns Hopkins University School of Education and CEO of the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools. He was director of the Center for Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships with the U.S. Department of Education and served as the 47th president of the Colorado State Senate. Gerard Robinson is also with us. He is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute on Education Policy Issues, and that covers a whole lot. It includes choice in public and private schools, implementation of K-12 standards, innovation in for-profit educational institutions. He was Commissioner of Education for the state of Florida and Secretary of Education for the Commonwealth of Virginia. Here's our phone number. Lines have been very crowded, but now they're a little more open. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. I am Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls. Karen in Eau Claire. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I have so many things that I would like to talk about. but I have three children, and I have an older child and then some twins, and they're all grown and gone now, so I'm done with the whole school thing. And I have to say that probably the greatest day of my parenting was the day the bus did not have to stop at my house and take my kids to school. Because I had such a terrible experience. I had my kids in private school through eighth grade, which was great. One of my children has a learning disability, and I had to remove that child from private school to put him in public school because I thought that they were going to give him a better education, which I was clearly mistaken. My daughter, who went through private school through eighth grade, when she got into high school, our school is so large that it is like the size of a small town. It's huge. And she went there and was appalled at the fact that the teachers did not expect 100% all the time. Because the private school expected you to get A's 100% of the time. And if you weren't, they were looking at what's being misunderstood. And it wasn't a matter that the school knew you were going to get 100%, but you were supposed to put forth your best effort. And when she went to public school, she was just shocked at the teacher's lackadaisical attitude towards the fact that, well, of course, we know you're not going to be able to get them all right, so just do as many as you can. The other thing was is that so my son was put into public school because of his learning disability, and he was immediately taken from, you know, there was, back then there wasn't a lot of integration.
What year was this, Karen?
The 90, let's see, they were born in 89, so...
okay.
Third grade, how old are we?
All right, we need to move this along a little because...
Okay, so, you know, he went to that school and they wanted to just keep him in LD class the entire day. And the teacher, his third grade teacher, took me aside and said, really, I can work with him. He doesn't need to be in there all day. And they just wanted him in there all day. It was terrible. So we didn't have, the other thing is that my son walked and talked and looked like he was perfectly normal.
Right.
So we really struggled getting services for him because the teachers really thought he was just being lazy.
All right. You're making a pretty broad statement about all kinds of teachers at a school. I'm sure there were some good ones here. But is there a difference, do you think, in what is expected from students, if we can be so general about this, in private school versus a large public school? Peter?
Well, if Karen makes an interesting point. One, it's unique as we have this conversation about choice, that she was able to move her children kind of in and out of situations that she had hoped would put them in better footing in terms of their preparation for college and a career. But, you know, we do hear a lot, and I think people kind of make broad statements about public schools versus private schools, but it is unique that her daughter was not expected to kind of perform, at least from the teacher standpoint, as she perceived it. And we hear that on occasion, but there are some public school teachers out there who every single day say to students, you can do better.
Sure there are.
And you have to do better, and you must do better. And so I think the unique piece about what Karen said was that she was able to move her children around. And I think for Gerard and I and those of us who work in this sector, it's about ensuring that parents like Karen can put their kids, whether they have a disability or not, in the best educational situation for them to excel.
Let's talk a little bit more about those who have dropped out. And it was interesting that many of the parents in the survey believed that the number was much higher than it actually is in this country, but many of them knew somebody in the family who had dropped out of high school. What does Pathways in Education do to address those group of students who really are not performing very well, who are turned off by the system and who just don't want to be there, and they leave? How do you bring those people back in, and how are they most effectively educated? Gerard?
So John Hall, founder and leader in this area, himself had a challenge when he was in school. Smart guy, but for a host of reasons, traditional schooling just didn't work well. And John realized that he wasn't the only person in the United States with this challenge. So when Pathways for Education is created, the goal is to find kids who've dropped out, who either the public school system or at my level at the state level, they're just simply not going to appear on my average daily membership list. And for financial reasons, they're off the sheet, but they still exist. And so there are a couple of things that Pathways in Education will do. One, it will reach out to students and provide them an opportunity to return to school to earn a diploma through either a blended learning model where some courses are taking place, in school, some are taking place online. I had a chance to visit one of the schools in the Los Angeles area where I talked to a number of students who said, frankly, if it wasn't for Pathways, I would not have found myself coming back into school and trying to actually engage in the learning process. That's not only in California, but other places as well. You know, at the state level, we do a lot to support superintendents and teachers, but to be very honest, when a kid leaves the system and they're not on our financial books and don't show up when I have to go and present to the state, in some ways they don't exist, and that's an unfair aspect. So one of my reasons for joining Pathways was to say we've got to do a better job of not only helping kids who've left behind, but kids who don't show up on our roll.
Karen, thanks for your call. Let's go quickly to Cal in Brookfield. About a minute left, everybody. Hi, Cal.
Hi. I'm really concerned about the issue of merit pay and who determines what teachers get merit pay. I'm a retired chemistry teacher. I had a Cole Fellowship. I have two master's degrees, American Chemical Society Teacher of the Year, and so on. When I have a supervisor whose teaching experience is Spanish or band, in what universe are they able to determine if I merit a pay raise or not?
Peter.
Well, I will speak to the program that I know best, which is the program in Douglas County, Colorado. A group of teachers came together with the district to determine what level performance a teacher in band or in science or even in PE would have to hit to make sure that they receive that that bonus or that merit pay. So the teachers were very much involved in Douglas County, and I think moving forward, teachers have to be involved in the conversation around what performance looks like. We can certainly use tests as part of that, but that shouldn't be the only determining factor in terms of how a teacher is judged to be proficient and eligible for a performance.
Thank you so much for your participation, both of you. Cal from Brookfield, thanks for your call. Our guest, Peter Groff, former president of the Colorado State Senate, Gerard Robinson, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this show and for on-air production. Katie and Scotty and I were almost exactly, well, the same color combination today. It's on Facebook if you want to see us. Today is the day of the red pants. Oh, and you know, if you are like us on Facebook, you'll know all the shows that are coming up. We won't bombard you, but we'll inform you. Thanks for listening. News is next.